Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. Today we take a look at your vegetable garden with the Vicars of Vegetables, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis, horticulture professors at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who enjoy talking about vegetables. They like to do haikus relating to vegetables, and I hope you will send in a haiku if you've got one about a vegetable. And I hope you'll call in with your questions and comments about vegetables at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Erwin Goldman, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
Yeah, Jim Nienhuis, good to see you.
God bless you, sir. Thank you.
We had quite a nice celebration on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the University of Wisconsin Department of Horticulture, Erwin.
We were 125 years. 125 years this year. And we held a fabulous anniversary celebration yesterday in Madison. We had 300 guests come from all over the country, alumni, friends, supporters. It was wonderful.
Oh, that sounds absolutely wonderful. And you've got some great stories. I mean, it's been an outstanding department.
We've had a great, you know, we were one of the four original departments of the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. When the college started in 1889, there was a Department of Horticulture, Department of Soil Science, a Department of Animal Husbandry, and a Department of Agricultural Chemistry. So we're the only one that still has the same name, horticulture. Soil science was called agricultural physics, and they all had different names. So we've kept this tradition going for 125 years. And our first professor was a guy by the name of Emmett Goff, who worked on fruit crops, and he popularized certain aspects of fruit crop growing around the state. His descendants, including his great-grandson, Charlie Goff, all came to the event yesterday. Oh. And they did something really fantastic. Goff himself, when he was here in the 1880s, planted a larch tree on the campus. And that larch tree is still there. Part of it fell down in a storm about 8 years ago. The wood was preserved, and the Goff family commissioned an artist to construct a bench from that wood. And that bench was unveiled yesterday at the ceremony.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have been studying a whole variety of vegetables. Erwin, I know you're a beet guy. You love beets, and you've done a lot of work with it. We had a Facebook question from Brianna, who has tried growing Ruby Queen beets for the first time. The greens were great, but they didn't bulb. She wants to try it again this fall with a little fertilizer and maybe thin them more. Do you have any other suggestions? Also, is there anything I can plant in their place now that it'll be ready to harvest in September when I want to put the beets in?
Well, I would actually plant the beets closer to July. I would do, if you want to do a fall harvest, say an October harvest of beets, I would plant them maybe towards the end of July. Make sure that you thin them. You shouldn't have any trouble getting good bulbs or good swollen roots by September if you do that.
And then, and what about the business of, using Ruby Queen? Is that a good beet?
Absolutely. Ruby Queen is a classic open pollinated variety. It's a mainstay. A lot of people use it. I think it's an excellent beet, and it should do very, very well here for her.
John and Boaz has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I mean, with all the rain we're getting, is it going to hurt my tomato plants with too much rain?
Well, it could have some impact. I would think, Jim.
I just went out and checked my tomatoes, and in fact, as long as you've got good drainage, I don't think there's going to be any really ill effects. You know, if we maintained high humidity and if we had low temperatures, we're certainly going to get things like Phytophthora. But it's going to dry out. You've got to have faith. Gardening requires faith above all. There is a sun out there. We have not seen it. It's not going away. It will come back. And it will dry the leaves, and you will have, I don't think there's going to be any negative effects.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for calling, John. Appreciate it. Susan in Mount Horeb, it's your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering, we have been using llama and alpaca manure in our gardens, and we've had great results, but we don't know whether it's really something that is great for gardens or not.
I think it depends on the amount of composting that gets done, wouldn't you say, Erwin?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it needs to be fairly aged, let's say.
Yeah.
Would you say night? How long, Larry? How long would you?
I would, a year?
Yeah. 9 months, a year, sure.
Okay. All right, great. Yes, we've got some very large piles, and it turns right into dirt very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Is that normal?
Go ahead.
That's composting. That's what it's all about, right? I mean,
right.
They're certainly not going to influence the flavor. I know you're looking forward to that llama and alpaca flavor to be somehow magically, you know, infused into the tomatoes. Sorry to say that's not going to happen, other than in your imagination.
Okay.
No, I don't want that. I just want the juicy tomatoes.
Oh, okay, Callie.
All right. Thanks, Susan. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a question about your vegetable garden, or do you have a vegetable haiku for us? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Tim in Butler sent us a Facebook comment. All my radishes this spring were devastated by tiny white larvae. Did we talk about that already? No, we didn't. What are they, if you know? And should I be worried about my neighboring carrots? So the radishes were eaten by some white larva, which could be, well, there's so many possibilities, it's hard to.
And none of which occur to me at this moment. Even though there are an infinite number of possibilities of what those white larvae might be, nothing is coming to my mind at this moment, Erwin. I'm sorry.
I can't think of it either. And I also can't think of exactly what it would be that would harm your carrots along those lines. So, not
so,
sure.
We're a little out of luck on that one.
And Pelletieri retired. So really, what options do we have available to us at this point?
Well, I tell you what, you mentioned the rain earlier, Jim, and it's been a really rainy weekend. What would be the major disease problems that we would want to be concerned of? Phytophthora?
Only if it gets, you know, if it maintains and it remains cool temperatures, sure. You could probably have that a bit. But if the sun comes out and if the temperatures get high, I really do not anticipate a lot of disease problems. The biggest problem you're going to have with these extended rains is weed control. There, you know, that is nearly impossible in muddy fields. Mm-hmm. Of course, those of you who have, you know, rejected dirt as a medium from which to grow vegetables, and now I understand you're using upside down old buckets and
Larry's using the straw bale.
Larry is using straw bales. Excuse me, I'm kind of a dirt guy. You know, like, what's the problem?
So how's the upside down gardening going?
It's totally fascinating. My mother-in-law is a big advocate of the upside down gardening, and I have to say, you know, I was a bit skeptical at first, but if you think about the weed situation, if you think about supporting the plants, and then you think also about the possibility of putting something on the top of the container, it's pretty efficient for an urban environment, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Jim's still skeptical.
Why have I rejected this idea? Is it just too avant-garde? Is it too nouveau? Is there something French about this that I have just, you know, failed to appreciate?
It's upsetting in a certain way, you know. Yeah. I mean, you like to grow your cucurbits, so you like the expansiveness of a cucurbit vine in the garden.
And I know you're looking at me saying anything that's out of the box, we would expect you to be the
right,
primary advocate of, Jim. And the fact that it's, you know, but I, for some reason, upside down gardening has never caught on with me. And I'm, you know, the dirt is down there,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I will have to admit, this has been a difficult spring.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bending. And mm-hmm. I've recognized that I simply do not bend as well as I used to. And there's been a lot of pain there, but I've been alleviating that with a combination of Advil and alcohol.
But with the upside down garden, you could actually harvest from your chair.
Yeah, the wheelchair. Yeah, that would I'm starting to rethink this.
All right.
I'm willing to move in new directions.
Fair enough.
And someday, if we could have an upside down straw bale, then we could have the ultimate, you know, vegetable production environment.
Well, I do have in my straw bale, I have squash growing out the side of the straw bale while the tomatoes grow out the top. So it's not upside down, but it's sideways.
In addition to my traditional method of acknowledging the existence of gravity, and Larry's upside down, and now sideways squash. Mm-hmm. Although lyrical, I think, you know, Larry, I really think there is a tremendous possibility here for a unique haiku to be developed on the sideways squash.
I think it's possible. Do you have a haiku, by the way?
I do. I always have my. I had to recite this recently at a meeting, so I'll do it for the listening audience. And remember, this is the love. You know, there's a combination between love and chili peppers, right? Mm-hmm. That I don't know. I've just been fascinated by over the years. And of course, my haiku is: love is a pepper. Its heat remains on your lips long after the first kiss.
Oh,
that's very nice.
Do you want to hear that in Spanish?
I would.
El amor es un chile. El picor se mantiene en los labios aún después del primer beso. Huh? Now, in Spanish,
it sounds fabulous.
Honest to God, people would run up and start hugging me. They were out of control. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, that is a great hike. I really like that one. I hope we get some more from our listeners. I had one earlier, and I can't find it on my Facebook page. It was there, and it's gone. Connie in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a comment on the llama and alpaca beans.
Yeah.
We use llamas and alpacas to guard our sheep, and the advantage is that they eliminate in one or two piles, so you can easily scoop them up. The beans do not have to be aged. They're one of the very few outputs that does not have to be aged. Mm. Cow manure, horse manure, and chicken should be aged because of the high nitrates and stuff. Because it's a slow-release fertilizer, it does not burn your plants. Like if you put non-aged cow manure on your garden, you're going to burn your plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the advantage of the llama is you do not have to, one, you only have a pile to pick up, and so it's easily accessible, and it doesn't have to be aged at all.
It's hard for me to imagine not aging manure, though, of any...
The nitrates are so low, it's not a problem. It's usually the nitrates or something like that, and, you know, cow manure has a lot of liquid in it. Llama does not.
Yeah. Yeah, I would still, it would be, I mean, there are other things other than nitrates that could be in manure that would, necessitate me doing some...
Composting.
Especially with a vegetable garden. I mean, with a flower garden, I wouldn't think about it. But a vegetable garden where it could be coming into it.
Think of a food safety issue.
Yeah, it's more of a food safety issue in my mind. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But I, Connie, thank you for calling.
That is interesting.
Yeah, it really is. Kurt in Grand Marsh, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Yes, good morning. I've been having a terrible problem with powdery mildew on my squash, both last year, frankly, well, it did kill the plant, and this year, it's already showing up.
Ooh.
And I have moved them in a different location from last year, and I'm still getting it. I was wondering if you could help.
Oh, boy, yeah, this I had powdery mildew as well. I mean, there's no great... level of resistance available. And if you have the right, and you know, it's one of the, remember that we cannot forget that disease, the disease triangle, that you not only have to have the pathogen available, but you also have the right, have to have the right environment and a susceptible host. Okay, we've already got the susceptible host. We also have, we already have the pathogen available to us. And the only way we're going to be able to control it really is through prayer.
Yeah, there's not much that can be done.
And or you, I mean, you can spray, but you know there are pesticides that are available that will dramatically reduce powdery mildew. But of course, that you know requires you to get out there with a backpack sprayer and do that extra work. And you know, a lot of people are concerned about applying the application of pesticides. In the right years, it's not going to happen every year. You're not going to have that powdery mildew, and you may have it so late in the season that it will not be a particular problem. But if it occurs early, it'll be.
Is the pathogen in the air? Is it in the soil? Where is the pathogen?
It's being transmitted through the air. You know, I mean, and it overwinters. So you're certainly going to have that pathogen available to us every year.
Maybe no growing avoiding them upside down, Jim,
yeah,
would be a way.
Or a straw bale.
Or a straw bale, yeah, would be a way to escape that.
I have no powdery mildew.
A product called Serenade last year, and it seemed to help.
And you know, and that's lyrical too. I mean, you were serenading your plants. You know, think of that. I mean, your neighbors are out there saying, "Oh, he's applying those evil pesticides," and you're saying, "No, no, no, I'm serenading my squash. I'm serenading my sideways squash." Isn't there a haiku in there?
There should be. Jim Neonous and Irwin Goldman, our Vicars of Vegetables guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Vicars of Vegetables today, Jim Neonhus and Irwin Goldman, UW-Madison horticulture professors. Great to have them along. If you have a gardening question or maybe you've got a gardening haiku, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email those questions and haikus at talk@wpr.org or post them on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Mike in West Bend, you're next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've had some issues with in the past years with cucumbers where these are like the straight eights and that sort of thing, but they don't grow straight. They start to curve and they come out U-shaped or fat on one end, skinny on the other, and I don't know what's going on with that.
That sounds like a pollination issue, right?
Yeah, probably a pollination issue. Yeah, if they're not, it's odd. The seed actually are the stimulus for the development of the maturing ovary. So in fact, if you have a problem with any reduction in pollinization, or you get fertilization of only seeds on one end, that end it'll tend to bulb. Now,
okay.
And so that will be a possible issue. You want to be careful what pesticides you might be applying that might be reducing your insect population out there, because of course they do require insect pollination, mm-hmm, out there. So you want to be careful of that. Now, why the straight eight curves is clearly, if you grow them either in the straw bale or upside down, and if they continue to curve, then I would write to the seed producer and, send them photographs of that. And they would have to be straight then, wouldn't they, Irwin?
That's right.
Someone told me that it had to do with inconsistent water supply, watering, rain.
No,
like
inconsistent
that.
Watering will do other things, but...
Not that.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
One other question a separate question?
Sure.
A friend of mine told... I mow my grass and I bag it. And then he said, "Hey, why don't you throw the grass on the exposed areas for weed control in your garden?" So I started doing that. It was very effective. Is there a possibility that might cause any damage or disease or anything?
Only if you've applied if there's lawn control, you know, with some chemicals or something, you may have a herbicide issue that might affect it. Otherwise, I'm fully in favor of exactly what you're doing. I don't use grass, but I use all of the leaves from mm-hmm. our neighborhood, mm-hmm. Irwin, and mm-hmm. I apply them
mulch
several feet thick, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I do anything I can to have, to not only have clean vegetables, but I like to be able to walk in my garden as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I fully agree with you. It just results in a cleaner product and avoids, you know, what Larry and Irwin are completely against, which is dirt. <You know?
laughs> Yes. And it is very fair. I don't use pesticides or anything like that.
Oh, that is great.
I don't see any problem with that. You know, it's going to compost that year it'll compost down. You'll turn it in. Every year it'll be cycling into your garden. Right. No problem.
Yeah. And that's what I do. I till it back into the soil at the end of the season, and then I do it again the following year.
You and I are soulmates in this.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You know, somebody had asked me about cabbage maggots, and when you mentioned tilling in the fall, that reminded me that if you have a cabbage maggot, you should be probably moving your...
Oh, yeah.
Moving your rotating.
Rotation, yes.
But one thing you can do that can help is fall tillage, because there's overwintering, and if you can expose, you're going to expose some of them at least and get rid of them. Anyway, that just popped into my head.
Yes, sir. We're there for you.
Marty in Lodi, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had a question about spraying for insects on apple trees. I did one spray right after the blossoms dropped, and I'm not sure when and how often I should spray after that.
Amaya isn't here yet.
It's kind of out of our league as a fruit question, but maybe Larry knows.
I can tell you there is a an extension publication on this, and you can go to the Learning Store, the UW Extension Learning Store online. And you can get the schedule of, you know, how often and so forth right from that publication. You can probably have it in about 5 minutes or less if you go right to the learningstore.uwex.edu.
Didn't we just hire a new fruits person?
We
who
did.
Will be here?
She'll be here in the fall.
And isn't she a poet as well?
She is a poet.
She's a poet and a fruit specialist, and she'll be here in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so this year, you may not be able to have that question immediately answered except through the extension publication, but pretty soon she's going to be here, and she sounds terrific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the schedule, I would just go right straight to the Learning Store, go to the mm-hmm. garden, I'm sorry, there are very clearly mm-hmm. marked areas where you can go and go to fruits and apples, and you'll find it right there.
Any cost associated with these, accessing this information?
No, you can read it for free online, or you can download it, or if you're at your extension office, you can pick one up. Sometimes there's a small, you know, 25 cents or something, or often it's just free. So it's a pretty good deal. Pretty good deal, Marty.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Jane in Rothschild wondered about ideas for mulch for her vegetable garden. We use grass clippings in the past. However, we have many weeds and lots of grass growing in the garden. I'm wondering if the grass recedes in the garden, what else can we use to keep the weeds down and hold the moisture in the garden? I if you're just clippings, you're not going to... Unless you're waiting for the grass to...
Yeah, unless it's flowered.
Flowered.
And you're actually using clippings that include seed. But what's wrong with leaf? I like the leaf litter, the leaf mulch, right?
Boy, you know, it's light and airy, and mm-hmm. it's... The only problem with this is, of course, that it's not just a high in carbon, it's completely carbon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you have to... It'll tie up all your nitrogen, so you have to fertilize, and you have to apply some sort of source, which might possibly be the Yama slow-release fertilizer would be a possibility there. But, you know, I am Mr. Mulch King, right? Mm-hmm. And no problem with that whatsoever, except that I recognize the fact that it will dramatically result in, you know, poor growth and because it will tie up your nutrients. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you have mulch. You have to apply fertilizer.
Justin in Milwaukee, who's a new gardener, asks, what is thinning? Do all vegetable plants need thinning?
Well, we typically overseed, so we'll plant more seeds than we know we're going to need in a row, and then thin by selecting out the plants that we don't want. So we have maybe you just choose the most vigorous ones in your row. That way you're going to get a much better formed vegetable. And I think beets are a great example of this. If we planted 100 seeds in a row, we really only have room for, say, 50 plants to make a nice round root. We need to thin them out. We need to thin them out when they're fairly young. So it's a good practice. Also, we sometimes don't know the germination rate of our seeds. So we overseed, and then we thin back.
And some of the seeds, to be perfectly honest, you know, radish seeds, good grief. It's, I mean, to try and plant one radish seed at a time is pretty much impossible for me anyway.
Well, it requires something greater than the bifocal.
Yes, that's right, a tweezers.
Oh, Dan in Eau Claire says he wrote the following haiku 40 years ago in fourth grade, and his teacher did not believe that he wrote it.
Well, we're here to solve
it. And here it is 40 years later, and 40
years
later,
still
not over that. I think it's a... Here we go, a fourth grader. A large spring garden fills my pantry with much love to enjoy all year.
You see how he tied the gardening and vegetable to love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really what it's all about. If you can do that with a haiku, then I think any fourth grade teacher should have, you know, just really, you know, acknowledged that.
Absolutely.
And respected that.
Absolutely.
Well, here's another one from Becky, who on Facebook sent this haiku. Oh, rain and more rain. Pile of mulch waiting to be spread. Mud pies, here I come.
Yeah, I'll have to say, what is the most difficult aspect of this continuous rain that we're having here in Wisconsin is the fact that the mulch, which previously was airy and light and could be manipulated with a pitchfork, now requires, you know, a motorized tractor, right? And you know, just looking at it, my back hurts even more.
Oh, man. You can join in, by the way. If you have a gardening question, I hope you'll reach us as we visit with the Vicars of Vegetables, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Horticulture. The number for you to call, and we'll get you on pretty quickly if you can do that, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org and post on my Facebook page as well at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Teresa on Facebook says, our hosta plants, transplants, went into what I'm guessing they call transplant shock. They are limp and lifeless. Here's the kicker. We're having our wedding in our backyard of our house in Janesville in August, and we have some sad hostas. Is there anything we can do? You know what? There are some things they can do.
As the honeymoon and wedding proceeds, right, I think that, you know, there's a symbolic aspect here. You know, the plants are wilted, lifeless. It's your life before that wedding and afterward. The plants will revive and grow, and there's be a spiritual and plant reawakenedness. I think this is going to be symbolic of the entire relationship.
I think Teresa, I bet you've already had a lot of water. So you probably, I mean, typically you'd say, well, your plants are going to need some water, but...
They've recovered.
They probably have water. But I think in this case, here's what I'd do. I wouldn't put a slow-release fertilizer. I'd put a faster-release fertilizer a little bit around those plants, and I think that would perk them up. That's what I do. As Erwin, you're nodding yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. It could be a fertility issue, and give them a little time. Your wedding is until August, so I think you have a little bit of time for them to recover.
You see the spiritual connections here, the fertility issues. There's all about. There's really.
You see a bigger picture.
I see a bigger picture. I feel there's a things, forces in nature are coming together here, and this is how I envision it.
Well, I'd lay a little fertilizer down. That's what I do right now. Mm-hmm. And if they happen to be dry, I'd water them. But mm-hmm. I can't imagine they're dry. Mm-hmm. Mary in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have an organic garden I'm working on.
Uh-huh.
And I had started some bush beans indoors. Because of the weather, I couldn't get them out there as early as I'd hoped. And they look spindly. I do have some beans starting on them, and they look good, but it's just the plant itself looks kind of weak. With the winds, they kind of bend over, and some of them are actually broken. And I've added cow manure, and that has seemed to perk them up a little bit, but I'm just wondering if there's anything else.
You know, we plant. How far north are you in Wisconsin?
Green Bay.
Green Bay.
Okay, not a problem. You can plant green beans, just direct seed them in the garden. In fact, you know what would be an interesting little experiment for you to do? Is your spindly plants are spindly because, you know, the lack of light. That's why they're, you know, becoming etiolated. So what you want to do, I bet if you ran the experiment, transplant those into the garden, and I bet if you direct seed right next to it, I'm willing to bet that even the direct seeded plants, seeds, will not only catch up, probably surpass them in their production ability. So I would not transplant garden beans. I would direct seed them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There you go.
Well, good. Great.
Yep.
Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, Mary. Jesse in Superior, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate your call. You've got a question about pumpkins.
I do. Every year I seem to plant pumpkins, and they come to the orange flower, but that's about it. They never seem to come to fruition with a nice big bulb at the end come September, October for Halloween. So how is there anything I can do to get them from the flower stage to the actual vegetable?
Now, you're in Superior, so you're
fine. Short season.
Yeah.
Okay, you got a little bit of a short season, and that could, you know, that's probably the number one issue, right, that you're being faced with. Boy, I don't know about early, you know, you probably want to have an early season variety, and I'm sort of scratching my head now trying to think of how early a season of variety you would have to have. I'm not really familiar with any. I would say now pumpkins, on the other hand, let's put it this way. I just rejected the idea of transplanting garden beans, but I'm willing to allow the transplanting of pumpkins. And that, you know, anything that allows you for season extension by transplanting to the garden, what you may want to do is, late season garden extension, you know, pumpkins are going to cover, there is no plastic that's going to allow you to cover 40 acres. You know, so what you're going to have to focus on is early season. Try it again next year and start your seedlings under a, you know, pretty intense garden light in your, you know, in your home. Make sure that they have lots of light so that those pumpkin seeds don't become etiolated. And try it again next year, but really try to get them out as early as possible, and use, you know, protective covers even in after transplanting. And I think that will getting them go. You may be north, it may be cool, but you know, you've got one thing going for you, even longer days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very, very true. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Peggy in Tigerton, it's your turn. Hi, Peg.
Good morning. Hi. Was it morning? Oh, it is. It still is. Okay. Thanks for taking my call. A little while ago, you were discussing a variety of mulches, and I haven't been real successful collecting lawn clippings. To me, that's really labor-intensive, but across my driveway is a tree plantation, and I can easily walk in there with a wheelbarrow and rake up, you know, lots and lots of very light pine needles. Mm-hmm. And this is the third year I've mulched my tomato plants with them and my potatoes, and my pumpkins and zucchini. And they do keep the weeds down. They keep the moisture in. I think they work great, and the best part of it all is they're free.
Yeah.
They don't use chemicals. They haven't been, the trees haven't been sprayed, so I'm not concerned about that. Someone said it would be an acidic thing, that I'm adding acid to the soil, but
if you, that would you be with
so
pine,
heavy,
you know,
I need that.
Pine,
I need,
with pine needles, it would be, you'll tend to have an acidity problem, but I've never had, I've checked the pH of the, I mean, I apply mulch in, you know, like copious amounts, you know, like, you know, feet thick, and I've not had any problems with pH. I think pine needles will tend to acidify a soil. Otherwise, I think we are in perfect harmony. Now, did you ask permission to go across the street?
And,
okay,
oh,
just curious about that, you know, because they're driving by thinking, you know, our plants are in the fall. Our plants shed leaves, and they're. Where are they?
You know? Actually, we
and they're all over in your tomatoes and potatoes, you know, and they're so they're going to go over and say, "Well, hey, how can we split this harvest?"
And we would gladly do
okay.
The other thing about a mulch that I've noticed with my tomato plants was that you know how those lower leaves sometimes turn yellow and
sure.
The plant is just horrible. It's a that is that from dirt splashing up from rain on the leaves and causing a you know, a a disease?
Sure, yeah, it could, you know, it very well could be. It's probably even more likely it's simply due to the fact that, you know, the lower leaves are not getting as much light as they are as are the upper leaves. So okay. They also could be diseased. And, of course, a lot of diseases will, you know, will be spread by splashing those dirt particles onto, you know, onto the leaf itself. I agree with you entirely, though. You know, a copious layer of mulch is simply going to provide, you can walk into your garden,
right,
you can harvest, you know, the tomatoes that lie on the soil are not going to become, you know, diseased, your cucumbers. Mulching is just one of the greatest things you can do. And, you know, mulch is almost, unless you have a neighbor that you can steal it from across the street, excuse me, that you can ask permission from across the street.
And straw has lots of weeds in it.
Oh, yeah, a lot
really
of straw.
Horrible thing. It was wonderful to use, but horrible.
But, you know, but there's a certain, well, you know, there's a straw aesthetic, though. I mean, there's kind of that,
yeah,
you know, that combination of colors out there, that golden.
Well, think golden pine needles.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, there we go.
All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Peggy. We are talking with the Vicars of Vegetables today, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nian, who's from the University of Wisconsin Department of Horticulture. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening again on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking vegetables today with our Vicars of Vegetables. Jim Nianus and Erwin Goldman, you can join in with your questions, vegetable garden questions, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Katie in Stevens Point has a question for you guys. Hi, Katie.
Hey, I just did amaranth for the first time this year. I started it inside and transplanted it about a month ago, and I also mulched with grass clippings, and I noticed it was growing really well, got a couple feet on it, and just the other day I looked out, and there were two or three of them that had kind of fallen over, and I looked, and they had some sort of mold around the base of the stem, and I was wondering if maybe that was something due to the grass clippings. I pulled away the clippings from around the bases, but I'm wondering what else I can do.
Well, you know, it may have created a sort of a microenvironment that did, you know, that may have contributed to a
powdery mildew something.
Well, a mold, you know, that could have grown onto the base. I'm sorry that we can't answer that question, but we can answer the question that you didn't ask, and that is why are you growing amaranth? Is it for the leaves or for the seeds? What are you, and what exactly is your favorite recipe?
actually, it just looks like fun. I saw it in a seed catalog, and I said, well, I'll try it. I was going to do the leaves. The bugs have been getting into the leaves a little bit lately, though, so they're kind of ragged. But, you know, I figure I'd like to get seed. If our season isn't long enough, it'll be a really pretty flower anyway. But, yeah, I'd like to do some seed from it. And I haven't really cooked with it a whole lot yet, so we'll find out.
Isn't it, in fact, Erwin, isn't this one of possibly one of the most nutritious leaves that is available?
It really is. I mean, the plant itself, I mean, you have seeds, you have edible leaves, you have, nutritionally, it's one of the finest.
And amaranth, this is this unique, a lot of plant. I mean, we're talking about photosynthesis, 3-3-3-4. Isn't this one of the, actually one of the best adapted plants?
Absolutely.
This was an ancient vegetable used. This is one of the ancient vegetables used by the Native Americans.
Absolutely.
Was amaranth, yeah. You know. And, you know, you can, and why this was not further domesticated in the United States into, why don't we have amaranth salad every day available to us? There was something odd happened in this country centuries ago in which we tended to adopt not only the South American vegetables, but also those that were sort of redomesticated and introduced from Europe. And we've discarded many of the vegetables that were native to here.
Yeah, the Americas.
How did we allow that to happen?
Yeah, well, amaranth is a great example of one. I agree with you, and it's wonderful that you're bringing it back to the garden.
And the fact that you had the mulch, you know, tightly around the plant is probably Jim was saying.
We don't like to talk about any negative aspects of mulching because we tend to, but it's possible that there may be some, you know, I don't acknowledge them, but I really don't know what that fungus, you know, might have been, you know, and I'm, you know, really brokenhearted to hear that it occurred to you. But on the other hand, I'm inspired by the fact that you're growing amaranth and that you're consuming it and you can think of yourself as redomesticating a Native American vegetable.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I should feel good about that, I think. Ray and Rhinelander. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is really enjoyable because we have a kind of a gardening session here that could be related to humor with click and clack with a touch of metaphysical spin horn philosophy. How do you like that one?
That's pretty good. I like that.
God bless you.
Yeah, I kind of thought you would. I mean, after listening today, it's been so enjoyable yet humorous, and it's really nice. Anyways, I have a question on late-season gardening.
Ooh.
Simply put, what to plant. And also, very interesting, you brought up amaranth. And there's been some studies on some of these, there's been an opinion study done on these crops that used to be all around here. And when the Puritans supposedly now came here versus the Native American culture, there were some clashes with a variety of things with that, supposedly. But anyways, I'll take the answer off the air, but I'd really like to know about late season gardening.
All right, and Ray's in Rhinelander, so we're north.
Boy, you could plant. I mean,
lots of things.
Absolutely,
huh?
You know, of course, spinach and you can would be great late season into the fall. But you can plant carrots right now if you want and harvest those in October. You plant beets. Harvest those late in the summer. I don't know what else would you suggest.
Oh, you know
Jim?
What? You know what I particularly like in Wisconsin is a late season, especially a fall season production of broccoli.
Oh, broccoli!
Broccoli,
absolutely.
Cauliflower,
absolutely.
They do so poorly in the spring. I mean, there's so many insect. You know, there's cycle after cycle of insect pests. But then in the fall season, you move into especially September, October. You know, you're able to go out into the garden and harvest, and it's a much higher quality.
Oh,
it's cool.
Broccoli
cool.
Is
yeah,
so
the
good.
Fall broccoli is a spectacular vegetable, and so that would be my recommendation. Now, Rhinelander, how you could plant those? I would guess in July.
I think in July would be perfect.
Sure.
Rhinelander's pretty close to the Arctic Circle, isn't it?
Okay, yeah,
it's pretty much up there. One of the nice things about late season gardening, of course, is you have a chance to let the weeds grow, and then you can get rid of them. Right? You can cultivate those weeds, and that's a plus too.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of them in the seed bed.
Oh, I've got broccoli on my mind now.
Yeah, me too.
I haven't. Really
I'm gonna look forward to plant. And the other thing is that some of those Chinese, vegetables as well. The bok choy, etc. Those do so much better into the fall. And the other, of course, is cilantro. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're moving into in the fall. One of the particular advantages that's often overlooked is that we're moving into short days.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the plants, some of the vegetables that tend to flower under long day conditions, you know, that you plant in the spring, you know, like cilantro or even, you know, even spinach, if you move in, if you're moving into the short days, you're going to, you know, you're going to preclude their flowering. This is one of the reasons why the Chinese sort of vegetables, you know, the pak choys, those sort of, you know, the stir-fry vegetables, which I'm, I bet you could grow really well in rye nettle as well.
That's perfect.
I bet, you know, they're not going to flower. You grow them in the spring, you know, they'll bolt.
Yeah.
But if you grow them in the, if you start them in July and let them grow into the fall, you know, I think they won't flower.
Yeah. Jim in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
You know, I thought since you guys were professors here that you might be able to answer this question, because I know my brother was a DNR manager for a while, and he's retired now.
The thought that professors should be able to answer questions is, well, I don't think that, have we ever been, is that on our job resume, Irwin? I don't remember that. We're able to obfuscate and as much as possible, and as you may have noticed that during this session, we hardly ever actually answer the question being asked. We answer the question that we would like to have been asked. We're politicians.
Well, the nice thing about my question is it's already obtuse enough that further obfuscation isn't necessary.
Okay, you know, well, that in itself is a haiku.
There you go. Write it down, man. My haikus are all by accident.
I love it.
So what's your question?
Well, my question is there a compound in the skin of the beet that might be similar, you know, to aspirin-related compounds? Was there ever any aspirin made from the skins of beets? The reason that I ask that is that I'm allergic to the skin of beets, and I'm coincidentally allergic, equally allergic to aspirin and the natural compounds made from the willow bark.
That's so interesting.
I was wondering if you might be aware of any compounds that might be similar and could cause that reaction, and where else they might be found in the plant world.
It's a great question. You know, I'm not aware of any salicylates or salicylic acid that is present in beet, whether in the skin or in the interior of the root. And it is the salicylates that are giving the aspirin-like effect that you would have from willow. However, I wonder if what you're allergic to is something other than the salicylic acid and is something that's produced by plants. The other natural source of salicylates would be spirea, which is a common garden plant. Yeah. You may have spirea there, and you'll find salicylic acid there. It's been used traditionally as an aspirin. But I guess the short answer to your question is no, I can't think of anything, but I think your allergy may have to do with something else other than that molecule.
Well, thanks very much. It was one thing I might add there, and that is a friend of mine had a juicer, and to give his juice a nice light red color, he had used beets. And then he said, well, here, try this. It was delicious, but the minute it hit my taste buds, it almost hadn't made it to my stomach yet before I had that beginning of that.
Oh, the hives.
Did your skin reacted?
Oh no! My stomach. I get all nauseated. My throat starts to close up. My head gets real stuffy. I get a mass production of sinus fluids. And then eventually the itching is the least of my problems and the last of the problems, you know.
Boy.
Could it be the geosmins?
You know, I don't think those are allergenic in that way. Many people experience a kind of an abrasion from eating raw beet because it has calcium oxalate crystals that cause some abrasion in the mouth and the back of the throat. But that sometimes feels like the beginning of an allergic reaction, but it sounds like yours is much more severe.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah,
I'm sorry for that, Jim. And probably you'd have to go through a whole regimen of testing in order to figure it out. And, you know, you may or may not want to do that, to be perfectly honest.
This is such a testament, though, to you, Irwin, and that there is this defines the fact that there is no question too obtuse.
That's right. We're interested in all of them.
Yes, they're all there for us. Yes,
absolutely.
And in fact, the fact that you were actually able to answer this question is also a testament to you. Thank you.
Oh, man. We have lots of people with questions here. Mary Lou, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. I have a problem in my garden of ants, little tiny ants, and not a big hill of them, just tiny little ant hills all over. And I put out some tomatoes and peppers and some sunflower seeds out there, plants that were already started. And it ate all the pepper leaves off, and it ate all the sunflower leaves, and then it left the tomatoes for a couple days, and then they crawled to the top of the tomatoes and started eating the leaves off those plants, too. So how could I get rid of those ants?
So you've actually watched the ants eating or have not?
No, I haven't, but that's the only thing there. There's no tracks from animals or... We don't have anything around here that I know would eat them. And and there are many, many little tiny anthills everywhere down there.
I don't think it's the ants. I bet it's not the ants.
I don't think it's the ants.
Yeah. I think there's some other insect or critter, and it could be a nocturnal critter.
It could be a squirrel. It could be a rabbit. It could be slugs, although slugs wouldn't get every single leaf.
Where is she located again? I'm sorry, Mary Lou. Where are you?
Mondovi.
Is that in the state of Wisconsin? Yeah.
Okay. So I would bet that it's not the ants, and I'm thinking more in terms of rabbits or squirrels or possibly something like slugs. But we need to remind you all that we have been visiting with the Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, who are professors at the University of Wisconsin in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network with my two guests, the Vicars of Vegetables, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis. Thanks so much to them for coming by, and thank you for listening in. If you have a question about your vegetables, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Drew in Brooklyn's been waiting a long time, so let's go to Drew. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Wonderful, and thanks for the opportunity. Two things. I use wheat straw religiously as my mulch, and I mulch my tomatoes as soon as I plant them and stake them. My question, I guess, is to pluck off the suckers or not to pluck off the suckers at the base of a tomato plant, allowing more air flow and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wheat straw is the way to go. Less weed seeds, and I'd rather till up wheat plants than quack grass. So.
Yeah, yeah.
A dedicated sucker plucker. So let me, I actually had some colleagues send me some emails about this the other day, and I said,
why would you remove them?
Yeah, why would you remove them? I think it's more of an aesthetic thing than a production thing. I mean, I don't see the need.
Well,
I've never done it.
If you take them off, it allows more air circulation around the bottom, you know?
If your tomato plant's upside down,
then why
you wouldn't have that problem.
Wouldn't matter, right?
Or if it was in straw.
Or if it was in straw, that's right.
Drew, I'm not going to be supportive of sucker plucking. I'm sorry.
All right.
No,
thanks.
But Larry is, and Irwin's, you know, not. I mean, clearly, I'm in the minority here.
All right. Pat in East Troy, your turn. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry and guests. I've been wondering how many more harvests I can take off my rhubarb plant without weakening it.
This is about the time.
Yeah, actually, I don't think there's actually any physical, or physiological reason. It's just that you just get so sick of feeding rhubarb. And I noticed that when I bring the rhubarb leaves back to my family, there's not that large rhubarb smile that I've seen earlier in May, I find a large rhubarb frown. And my wife says that if you make that stupid rhubarb cake again, you know, I can't even repeat the things that have been expressed to me about it. Well, so I don't think you're actually going to kill the plant, but I think, I just think you won't have any family left.
You haven't tried my rhubarb pie. I had rave reviews, and the people who raved about it are coming back, and I was going to see if I could eke out one more pie.
Yeah, they will. They will have rave reviews, and then by the third time that you prepare that pie, they will have expected you to have moved on.
I would take one more. We got some people coming at once and rhubarb pie. Pat, go for it.
Don't listen to Jim. Just keep going.
Oh, and, you know, if you ever have an extra rhubarb pie.
In lieu of your contribution to public radio, you can send rhubarb pie.
I don't think you're
going to. I mean, how late actually can you harvest without?
Well, you reach a point around the here towards the end of June, beginning of July, where I don't think you should probably take too much more from the plant.
Yeah, because you want the plant to recover so that it will produce that'll put those storage carbohydrates. So at some point, you want to say to your plant, you know, it's like saying to the plant, thank you.
Yeah.
Now, please.
Now it's your turn.
Now it's your turn. Continue to grow. And could you please store that photosynthate in the root so that next spring I can harvest once again and drive away even larger numbers of neighbors with the third time we're having rhubarb pie.
You recently started, Irwin, I want you to talk about this. You started an effort to launch open source vegetable seeds. And, you know, for those who aren't aware, I think it's really, let's talk about this. What is this open source seed initiative?
Well, some of the listeners may be familiar with open source software. And I think if you use Firefox as your browser on the internet, for example, that's an open source software product. And the idea behind open source seeds is somewhat similar. You can get some seeds, you can save them, you can replant them, you can breed with them, you can trade them with your neighbor, and there's no legal restrictions. And I think the open source seed project was partly a response to the fact that many of our seeds today are restricted in some way through patents or licenses.
And so how do people learn more about what's going on with this?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way for a listener to get some information on it would be to look at www.opensourceseedinitiative.org. And that's a website that has a lot of information about the project. It also has a way for people to request seeds of a number of different varieties. We have 37 different varieties of 14 different crops that are now out there on an open source framework that they can get access to.
Well, that's wonderful. This has been going on for just this recent?
The launch of the project was April 17th of this year. We wanted to do it in time for the season, but the germ of this idea goes back several years with a group of gardeners and farmers and plant breeders trying to figure out how can we take some varieties and put them aside in a sort of a protected commons. I mean, Larry, the way I think of it is like a national park. We're basically taking some varieties. We're setting them aside. We're saying you can do whatever you want with these. They're in the public domain. They're going to remain in the public domain for people to use. Nothing wrong with protected varieties, but we wanted to make sure that there were some set aside for people to save and trade and do whatever they wanted with.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Very good idea. Mm-hmm. And again, it's where do you go again?
You can look at www.opensourceseedinitiative.org.
Maybe we can put that up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'll put a link up there, and that should help. Rose in Ashland, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have four different varieties of peppers. Three of them we started and one variety we bought. The ones that I started all have a nice healthy green color to them. And the ones that I bought have kind of a yellowish green.
You're talking about the leaves themselves.
Say that again?
You're talking about the leaves, I'm sorry. They're just sort of... They're sort of yellowish. They were probably over there at Menards just a little bit too long, probably the Menards help didn't fertilize them a little bit.
Well, I got them through the mail.
Oh.
And they look healthy except the color.
Now what four peppers are you growing? Tell us a little bit about. Are these bells, or are you into hot peppers?
No. The ones that I bought are the ghost peppers.
Okay, yeah. That's a completely. I'm so glad you told me that. That's a completely different species. It's almost 99% of the peppers that we grow are Capsicum annuum. The ghost pepper is actually a different species. It's called Capsicum chinense. It's actually from Brazil, not from China. But that's a whole other story about how taxonomists, should avoid alcohol. But the actual leaves will actually look and be perceived to be different, right? So I actually have some of the ghost pepper. We grow them, and they're just going to look completely different from your annuums. So rather than here, I was laying the blame on the part time labor over there at the garden center at Menards, and in fact, it's simply she's simply growing a different. A different species. It's
okay,
Capsicum
so
annuum. It's Capsicum chinense.
I won't worry about them.
Don't you worry. You're going to have a little trouble maturing them in Ashland.
Okay.
You're going to probably Rose, on your next trip south. You'll probably want to stop by my garden, and I'll give you some fruit of the because you only need one. Actually, you only need one small pepper to provide you with all the capsaicin you will ever want your entire life.
They're really hot.
Yeah, yeah. I would say hot. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Burning.
Well, this is an experiment. I'm glad to hear that you also grow them.
I do indeed. I grow them for class, but I keep them away from the students because I'm terrified that they will bite into them, and then who knows?
Drop over.
Yeah, well, the lawsuits, or whatever.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, I'm glad I called.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm glad you called too, Rose. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And you got the pepper guy here now. Jim is known for his peppers.
Mm-hmm. God bless you. Yeah.
Very much known for his peppers. Mm-hmm. Nancy in Sherwood, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. I actually have haiku, if I could start out with that.
All right.
Okay. And a little bit of alliteration, too. Bounty below beet, peel, pull, prepare, partake, buttered burgundy.
Oh.
So anyway, my question is, I am actually a middle school English teacher, and for 2 years I haven't been planting because it's the grade time. So I have seeds that are like 2 years old, like mm-hmm. for beets and lettuce. Mm-hmm. First of all, is it too late to do any planting, and would it behoove me to go get fresher seeds?
No, that should be just fine. I mean, part of it depends on how your seeds were stored. Were they at room temperature?
They're at room temperature.
Yeah, they'll probably germinate. I mean, we like to store them in a cool temperature and dry conditions, but I think you'll get some germination, and I think you can use them.
Okay, just plant lots of them and pull.
I grew some, just as an aside, I had some tomato seeds that I harvested in 1996, right? And I found the package because my office is a little messy. they've actually been... They've been there somewhere, and they actually germinated fine.
Nice,
especially if you store them in a room that's air conditioned. Now mm-hmm. We're not provided with that at the university, mm-hmm. but if mm-hmm. you have air conditioning, it's often not so much the temperature; it's the relative humidity.
Yeah.
So anything you can do to reduce the relative humidity mm-hmm. is going to allow for your seeds to remain viable longer, but it's often surprising how long it's the surprises on both ends. Sometimes if you store seed in a high temperature, high humidity environment, it's surprising how quickly they will deteriorate.
They do deteriorate.
And in fact, but if you store them in a relatively low temperature, room temperature is fine, but with air conditioning, you can reduce
really
the relative humidity, and it's surprising how long the seeds will remain viable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm. And you could still plant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were talking about planting for fall, and mm-hmm. Just go right ahead. Absolutely. Lettuce, would you wait a little bit on that?
Yeah, it's a little warm. I mean, you might want to wait and do a fall crop there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lettuce doesn't do so well in the heat. But.
Yeah. There you go, Nancy. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We have Casey and Toma up next, I believe. Casey, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I had a comment about the lady who called about the ants.
Yeah.
I definitely have ants eating my strawberries and my beans. Definitely, I've been watching them. Now, I was just thinking about it. Maybe something else is eating them, and the ants are eating the nectar from the broken leaf, or the leaf no longer exists. But my strawberries are crawling with ants, and I have these little tiny ant hills all over, just like she said, just like she described. And I sit out there, and I don't see any critters. I saw a rabbit, but I don't think a rabbit could come in there. At first, that's what I thought it was, but then I started looking closely, and I see ants crawling all over it and eating several ants on the ends of the nubs.
Hmm.
It's the ants eating to me, it looks like the ants eating the leaves right off the plant.
So they're eating they're on the leaves, not the strawberries themselves.
No, not the strawberries themselves. They're eating the plant itself. The plant is not thriving, and I'm wondering why, and there's ants crawling all over it.
You know, I would do one more experiment. I would wait till it's dark, and I would go out with a flashlight, and I would look to see what might be out there eating in the dark. Because like cutworms, for example, they eat at night.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't be cutworms probably, but you might want to try that, because typically what ants are doing is they're after something that somebody else has already kind of broken into.
And you might be able to see that grasshopper with the violin. Remember that out there who's not working, right? Who's just looking forward to the ants to provide him with his meal.
Just off my patio, and I have the solar lights, and I'm out there until very late at night reading, usually with the book light.
Well, you might just jump up before you go to bed and go out there with a flashlight and see if there's not, you know, I'm sure, you know, you watched with your own eyes, and you've got those ants there, and they seem to be eating, but I there may be something else also eating and doing it at night.
Because they're not going to be, you know, it's not like the tropics where you'd have leafcutter, you know, ants.
No, yeah.
Yeah, we're here to learn, and we're all here to learn, and golly, you know, these are just intriguing mysteries of what these ants are doing. And so we're going to have to, you know, call Phil out of retirement and try to clarify this ant situation for us, because I think we all need to learn from this experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Phil is still doing shows with me. He was on Wednesday, as a matter of fact, so... had I known that this question was going to come up, I would definitely have asked it.
Okay, well, you can just say Casey called last week, and Jim and Irwin were just, you know, just sat there, you know, and did nothing, you know, and Phil, please bail them out.
Oh man, Casey, thank you so much. Thanks for calling, and I want to give Nancy and Thorpe a chance to join in. Nancy, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm wondering if the age of a seed matters, and also if perhaps it would have ever froze seeds. I found from Poland, the envelope was marked in my grandma's stuff, seeds from Poland, tomato seeds, and I'm wondering those two answers to those two questions.
Wow,
that's a great question. You'd be surprised. Often, I am often surprised at how seeds can remain viable for long periods of time. Now, will the freezing of the seeds, which is going to also dramatically reduce, right, the relative humidity, right, and the water, you know, would it have would it have, if the seeds were frozen while they were still fresh and had a high water content, you would expect that ice crystals, you know, would disrupt membranes and in fact would cause damage. But if the seeds are dry enough when they were stored before they were frozen, I bet there will be no damage.
I bet you're right. And in fact, I think cryopreservation is increasingly used as a technique for preserving seed for very long periods of time. But Jim's exactly right. It'll depend on how much moisture was in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay.
That's going to be a fun experiment.
Golly, yeah, honest to God, is that going to be fun or what? I mean, grandma's seeds from Poland?
Right.
Golly.
Yeah, right.
Are we looking forward to finding? You're going to have to call back. This is just like click and clack, right? Were we given an answer, right? And we were wrong. And then you're going to have to call back and tell us whether or not grandma's seeds from Poland actually germinated and what they taste like.
Right. And what kind were they? Yeah.
Well, look, golly, we're looking forward to finding out. Casey, Nancy, we've written this down. You're going to have to call back. Thank you.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You bet. Deborah in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I didn't quite perfect it, but I came up with this little poem. Wildflowers and veggies sleep comfy in beds. It is an old sofa where I lay my head. A well-rested person performs through the day, but a well-rested veggie makes me feel good all day.
Oh.
And a
well-rested veggie.
I eat the veggie, so they deserve a good night's sleep also.
Gosh. You know, the mental image, right, of a well-rested veggie. Thank you. Thank you, Deborah.
Deb.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah, well done. It's a nice poem. Post that on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post that. Oh, Doug in Central Indiana. This is the first year of growing pink banana squash. Any suggestions on fertilizing? I think higher nitrogen for growth and phosphate for bloom, or will just the general purpose triple 12 analysis work?
I would, pink banana is Cucurbita maxima, and you know they can be like several feet long, right? And they're just a wonderful squash, and I really enjoy them. And squash are, you know, they are just nitrophiles. The more nitrogen that you can provide, you know, they will take, you know, incredible amounts. So I would fertilize them heavily and look forward to a bountiful harvest. And the banana squash will actually store for a long period of time. I'll tell you a quick story. I made a cross between the pink banana, which is Cucurbita maxima, and I crossed it with buttercup, right? Mm. Which is that little green sort of. I made that squash, that hybrid, and I have those out in our experimental field out there at Eagle Heights right now, and I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of an unusual shape I've come up with.
That's cool.
So come visit us at Eagle Heights, and I'll show you the cross of the pink banana by the buttercup.
Oh boy, this has been a lot of fun, you guys. Appreciate so much you taking time to be with us. I hope we can still have time to talk more about vegetables in another month or so.
Well, you have to invite us back.
Well, we'll do that.
Okay.
We'll do that. Jim Nianus and Irwin Goldman are vicars of vegetables, UW-Madison horticulture professors. They will be with us again for sure. We'll talk some more about the vegetable garden. Monday, Judith is sitting in for me, and we'll be talking about some new breakthroughs in the treatment of asthma, and, of course, taking your calls about that. And then there's another study out looking at whether teenage brains are more inclined toward risk-taking. I think I would probably say yes. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.